Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 126. It's Monday, August 9th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, COVID-19 is blooming all over the country. And an image from Florida sums it up pretty well. There is a vaccination site right next to a testing site. And there is a two-hour wait to get tested at the testing site while there is no one at the vaccination site. This is a perfect illustration of how we have and continue to fail at prevention. Tens of millions of Americans declined safe, effective, free, and accessible vaccinations. And many of these same folks won't even wear a mask to protect themselves or others in their family, community, or nation. As I speak, hundreds of thousands of motorcyclists are descending upon South Dakota for a 10-day festival, replete with close indoor contact, few masks, and many unvaccinated folks. Last year's event was a super spreader launching our summer surge. Now, with the summer surge well underway, and with record attendance, this year's event is sure to be a mass accelerator of viral spread over much of the country. So, COVID-19 continues to dominate public health news. But I do promise, well, we'll get to some non-COVID public health news in the latter half of the show. Okay, well, let's start with some of the ever-evolving science as we learn more about this virus. This from Medical Express. Fully vaccinated, one-third is likely to get COVID, England study. Fully vaccinated people in England were one-third as likely to test positive for COVID-19, according to an ongoing survey of the population released last Wednesday. They showed 1 in 160 people infected from coronavirus, with a prevalence of 1.2% for unvaccinated respondents and 0.4% for those fully jabbed. So this is one of the things that relates to that CDC bombshell a week and a half or two ago that basically said that people that are fully vaccinated, there's a lot of breakthrough infections. The severity of disease is still pretty well protected, actually excellently protected. But this is some more research showing that the protection from infection only may be about two-thirds, while the protection for severe disease may be well into the 90%. Well, next up from the Hill, the CDC says unvaccinated more than twice as likely to get COVID-19 reinfection. Unvaccinated people are more than twice as likely than the fully vaccinated to get reinfected with COVID-19, according to a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study released Friday. The CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report counters the argument that people previously infected with the coronavirus don't need the vaccine because natural immunity offers enough protection. The agency has already recommended that people previously infected with COVID-19 get vaccinated for more protection. Reinfection has previously been studied in laboratory settings, but the CDC noted there has been limited real-world data on the subject. In this study, which took its data recently but ended in May or June, the highly contagious Delta variant was not as prevalent in May and June, but has since become the dominant strain in the U.S. At the time of the study, the Alpha strain was the most common. So this fact that the people that have previous infection are are more than twice as likely to get a reinfection compared to fully vaccinated people. That gap would be even wider to be expected with the Delta, which really seems to cut into antibody protection, whether it's from natural immunity or from vaccination. But in some good news for those who have been previously infected and are wondering whether to get vaccinated or not, this from Medical Express. One dose of Pfizer vaccine may be enough for folks who've had COVID. I think I've had COVID already, so do I really need two doses of vaccine? It's a question millions of people around the world are asking. And now a small new study finds that people who know they were infected with SARS-CoV-2 in the past may need only one shot of the Pfizer vaccine to gain strong immunity. In fact, we observed SARS-CoV-2 antibody levels in previously infected individuals after one dose of the Pfizer vaccine compared with infection-naive individuals after two doses, concluded a team led by Dr. James Moy of the Division of Allergy and Immunology at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. What's more, giving previously infected people a second dose of the Pfizer vaccine did little to boost their antibody levels further, suggesting that one dose may be acceptable in this group, the researchers added. The bottom line? Individuals with a documented prior COVID-19 infection may be sufficiently protected from reinfection after a single mRNA vaccine dose, which could free up availability of millions of additional doses. The study highlighted that prior infection alone is not a robust defense against COVID-19. At baseline, the units in blood samples for antibodies against SARS-CoV-2 in people who had been previously encountered the virus was about 600. After one dose of the Pfizer vaccine, that level soared to a much more protective level of 30,000. Adding a second dose of vaccine only nudged that number up slightly to about 37,000. For folks who have never encountered SARS-CoV-2 before, two vaccine doses were definitely needed to reach a good level of antibodies. After one dose, this group's antibodies averaged just over 1,800 units in blood samples. But after getting a second dose, that number jumped to more than 15,000, the research team said. Okay, well, they don't really... There's really interesting in here is that, okay, so the level of antibodies produced for somebody who gets infected is around 600. For somebody who gets a single dose of the Pfizer vaccine, that number is like 1,800. So even one dose of the Pfizer, it offers about three times the amount of antibody protection as having had a natural infection. But if somebody who had natural infection gets even a single dose, it jacks us way up above even what somebody who hasn't been infected would get with two doses. So this was, people suspect this for a long time, but now we're seeing some studies to confirm this. So while two doses of the Pfizer vaccine are essential if you've never had COVID-19, one dose may be enough if you've already had it, the team concluded. One expert in infectious disease said the findings could be important to vaccine rollouts across the United States and globally. Some proportion of the vaccine hesitant are those who've had prior infection, who are confused as to why they should be treated exactly as somebody without any prior immunity, explained Dr. Amish Adagila, who wasn't involved in the new research. The data should be used by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to update recommendations for those who've had prior infection, allowing them to need just one dose of the two-dose vaccines to be considered fully vaccinated, said Adalja, who is senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. This could increase the number of people vaccinated and remove a talking point of the anti-vaccine groups who say that prior natural immunity is being ignored, he added. Well, and up next, this is for those folks who still think that getting a case of COVID is some short run of a minor illness. This from Science Daily. Research shows many with mild COVID-19 infections still experience long-term symptoms. The majority of individuals who experience mild or moderate COVID-19 infection also experience long COVID or persistent symptoms more than 30 days after they test positive, according to research data from the longitudinal COVID-HORT study at the University of Arizona Health Sciences. We showed that an estimated 67% of people with mild or moderate COVID have long COVID. In other words, they still have symptoms more than 30 days after their positive test, said lead researcher Melanie Bell, a biostatistics professor at the College of Public Health. This is a real wake-up call for anyone who's not been vaccinated. If you get COVID, the chances are you experience long-term symptoms surprisingly high. Among participants who tested positive for COVID-19, 69% experienced at least one symptom after 30 days, marking the distinction for long COVID. This prevalence actually increased to 77% after 60 days of follow-up. Researchers also found that individuals who experienced long COVID were more likely to be less educated, have seasonal allergies and pre-existing health conditions, and self-report greater symptom severity than people without long COVID. Individuals with long COVID who were surveyed 30 days after a positive test reported, in order of prevalence, fatigue, shortness of breath, brain fog, stress anxiety, altered taste or smell, body aches and muscle pain, insomnia, headaches, joint pain, and congestion, the 10 most common long COVID-19 symptoms, long COVID symptoms. For this study, the estimated prevalence of long-term COVID is only slightly less than prevalence estimated reported for hospitalized individuals. This suggests that non-hospitalized individuals with COVID-19 infection may experience long COVID symptoms almost as often as hospitalized individuals. Well, folks, let's listen to the science, not the myriad of bunk circulating around the internet. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, now I'd like to cover something that I haven't reported a lot on, but I have been following it closely, and that is vaccine mandates. And I want to do a longer article from the public health law expert Larry Gostin. Vaccine mandates are lawful, effective, and based on rock-solid science. The U.S. has reached a worrying plateau in its COVID-19 vaccination coverage, with just half of the population fully vaccinated. This coincides with pandemic fatigue or weak compliance with COVID-19 risk mitigation measures such as masking and distancing, and the highly infectious Delta variant, which accounts for more than 90% of infections. We're at an inflection point in the pandemic, with coronavirus infections soaring by about 140% in the past 2 weeks. Reflecting deep concern over lagging vaccinations, the Biden administration recently mandated vaccinations for all federal workers and contractors, with masking and regular testing as an alternative option. While the Department of Veterans Affairs issued mandates for all frontline health workers at its facilities, President Joe Biden also ordered the military to move towards compulsory vaccinations. California, New York City, and New York State are leading the way in requiring that government workers get vaccinated or else submit to weekly testing. And New York City just announced its Key to New York City Pass, requiring proof of vaccination for access to most indoor activities, including gyms, restaurants, and performances, beginning on September 13th, the first policy of its kind in the U.S. Meanwhile, more hospitals and long-term care facilities are implementing mandates following a joint statement from 100 medical and nursing groups urging compulsory vaccinations. And when schools of higher education return in the fall, nearly 600 colleges and universities will require vaccination. That's true in the private sector as well, as a rising tide of business like Uber, Facebook, Google, Netflix, and Delta Airlines mandate vaccinations for workers. Are these mandates lawful and ethical? The short answer is emphatically yes, and there's a strong behavioral science evidence that mandates will be highly effective. The lawfulness of COVID-19 mandates. Businesses. Both the Department of Justice and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission have ruled that businesses may lawfully require workers to get a COVID-19 vaccine as a condition of coming to the workplace. However, businesses must grant legitimate medical or religious exemptions. The only major court ruling to date upheld Houston Methodist Hospital's COVID-19 vaccine mandate. The private sector has wide discretion in setting conditions for workers and customers, and businesses have a legal and ethical duty to keep the workplace safe. Currently, all COVID-19 vaccines are administered under an emergency use authorization and are not fully licensed. The Department of Justice and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission specifically stated that employer mandates may occur even under an emergency use authorization. The U.S. is already acting as if the vaccines were fully approved, with public health agencies recommending that all eligible Americans get a shot. In any event, the Food and Drug Administration recently announced it is expediting full licensure of the Pfizer vaccine. That is likely to occur by September, with other vaccines not far behind. When the FDA does approve COVID-19 vaccines, more businesses are likely to require immunizations. Federal and state governments. States have long had the constitutional authority to mandate vaccinations, which the Supreme Court has upheld twice, first in 1905 and then in 1922. The federal government, however, has limited power to mandate vaccines. It can only require them to prevent transmission of a dangerous infectious disease across state lines or international borders. The federal government has never sought to require nationwide vaccinations, and the courts probably would not allow it. To date, all state government mandates have been for fully approved vaccines. Thus, it is likely cities and states would wait to mandate COVID-19 vaccines until they were fully licensed. But when governments act as employers, they would be in a similar legal position as businesses. Thus, federal and state worker COVID-19 vaccine mandates are lawful, even under the emergency use authorization. What about K through 12 schools? Every state in Washington, D.C. require routine vaccination, such as for measles, mumps, and rubella, as a condition of school attendance. While state mandates vary, all are based on a long list of childhood vaccinations recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In 1922, the Supreme Court upheld school mandates, and all courts have recognized the state's authority to mandate fully approved vaccines. Schools must offer medical exemptions for those who may be harmed by vaccines, but they do not have to grant religious or conscientious objections. Six states offer neither personal nor religious exemptions for school mandates, a move that the courts have upheld. Because K-12 COVID-19 mandates would be issued directly by the government, they are likely to require full FDA licensure. Further, the FDA's emergency use authorization for Pfizer's COVID vaccine currently applies only to people aged 12 and older, and the other two COVID vaccine authorizations are only for adults. Clinical trials for children younger than 12 years old are currently underway, but may not report full results until late this year or early 2022. What about institutions of higher learning? In most respects, the institutions of higher education are in similar position to businesses. They have long required vaccination of students for human papillomavirus, meningococcus, and influenza, for example. A federal court has already ruled that Indiana University's COVID-19 mandate is a reasonable, science-based measure to ensure student health and safety. And the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit just affirmed that Indiana University's mandate was lawful. Institutes for Higher Education act in loco parentis and thus have a duty to care for the safety and security of students on campus. While most of the institutions of higher education COVID-19 mandates apply to students, many also apply to faculty and staff. Anti-vaccination laws. While there is a rising tide of governments, businesses, and institutes of higher education mandating COVID-19 vaccinations, some states are actually seeking to restrict vaccine mandates. More than a dozen states have enacted laws prohibiting mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations or even proof of vaccination, so-called vaccine passports. Many more have bills pending. A number of governors have issued executive orders prohibiting COVID-19 vaccine mandates or vaccine passports. These edicts restrict private businesses, schools, and institutes of higher education from asking for proof of vaccination. COVID-19 has been politicized like no virus before. from AIDS and tuberculosis to Zika, influenza, and Ebola, states previously acted to enhance public health powers. A multitude of states are doing the opposite during this pandemic, tying the hands of health officials to act quickly and decisively. That will not only make it harder to fight COVID-19, but also the next health crisis. States have wide powers to regulate businesses, so even if these laws and executive orders are harmful, they still may be lawful. The exception may be states' attempts to regulate businesses that operate on interstate or international commerce. There is litigation regarding Florida's attempt to ban the cruise ships industry from requiring passengers and crews to show their vaccination status. Recently, a federal court of appeals unanimously voted against a CDC order regulating cruise ships, which Florida has challenged. It was a bizarre case because the decision reversed the appeals panel's earlier 2-1 ruling, which temporarily blocked a lower court's decision to uphold Florida's ban, and the appeals court has yet to give its reasoning for the change. The Constitution is quite clear that Congress holds the sole power to regulate interstate and international commerce. Are vaccine mandates effective? There is considerable behavioral scientific data that vaccine mandates are effective. That includes both hard mandates, required vaccinations for school or workplace attendance, and soft mandates, the choice to vaccinate or undergo regular testing and indoor masking. Hospitals that have required influenza vaccinations have achieved and maintained far higher coverage than those that make it voluntary. At the same time, K-12 schools and institutions of higher education mandates have given the U.S. high vaccination rates. Many business and educational mandates fall into the hard category, that is, students or workers cannot attend classes or the workplace unless they are fully vaccinated. Soft mandates nudge people to get vaccinated. When getting a vaccine is easier or a default option, most opt for the jab. Thus, when given the chance between getting a vaccine or having to undergo one or two SARS-CoV-2 tests weekly and masking up, most people will eventually roll up their sleeves. How do we know? Well, in states that have wide and easy exemptions for childhood vaccines, a significant number of parents opt out. But if a state makes getting the exemption hard, such as requiring a written declaration, a doctor's certificate, or attending vaccine literacy classes, vaccine hesitancy melts away. The same will happen for COVID-19 vaccinations. Are COVID-19 vaccine mandates ethical? People cite bodily integrity, personal liberty, and freedom as the most common justifications for refusing vaccines. But these arguments don't hold water. It's true that everyone has the right to refuse a medical intervention for their own good, but vaccines not only protect the person vaccinated, but also that person's family, neighbors, and classmates or coworkers. No one has the right to go into a crowded classroom or workplace unmasked and unvaccinated. Vaccine mandates do not unethically discriminate. Discrimination is wrong when it's based on irrational reasons or animus, such as discrimination based on race, gender, or disability. But vaccine mandates are simply a tool, and they apply equally to everyone. They don't impute blame or seek to shame the unvaccinated. They are intended only to keep the entire population safe. Finally, requiring proof of vaccination does not violate a person's privacy. Individuals are free to decline to give information about whether they received a shot, but if they do decline, they must expect reasonable consequences to ensure everyone's health. Additionally, federal health information privacy rules apply principally to healthcare providers and not to businesses or schools. There's also a public health exception to privacy rules. Requiring people to get a vaccine is part of the fabric of American history, going back to the Revolutionary War. General George Washington compelled troops to get a smallpox variolation, saying it was necessary to safeguard soldiers and to win the war. And not only is mandating vaccination lawful, but is also an ethical responsibility. For far too long, Americans have asked the question, what entitlements do I have as a rights-bearing citizen? It is now time to ask, what duties do I owe to my neighbors, my community, and my country? Getting a COVID-19 vaccination as the nation and the world are undergoing a historic health crisis is badly needed for the common good and mutual solidarity. Well, folks, vaccine mandates have been very controversial, but I expect that in practice this will change quickly in the coming weeks as this surge presents more and more death and disability among people. As an example of that, this from Medical Express. Largest operator of nursing homes in the United States issues vaccine mandate for all workers. The United States' largest operator of nursing homes said last Wednesday that its workers must get vaccinated against COVID-19 if they want to keep their jobs. The announcement from Pennsylvania-based Genesis Healthcare, which has 70,000 employees in near 400 nursing homes and senior communities, suggests the nursing home industry's reluctance to force employees to get vaccinated due to fears about losing too many workers may be shifting, the Associated Press reported. Understaffing is a major problem in the sector, but concerns about the surging Delta variant may convince nursing home owners they need to take action to quickly vaccinate the 40% of employees who still haven't received shots. Voluntary vaccination was appropriate early in the pandemic, but only 65% of Genesis staff have received shots, according to the company. Employees have until August 23rd to get their first shot. To succeed against the Delta variant is going to require much higher vaccination rates, Genesis Chief Medical Officer Richard Pfeiffer told the Associated Press. Our tactics in the fight have to change. About 80% of nursing home residents have been vaccinated, but even vaccinated residents are at risk because many are frail and have weak immune systems. And the public at large is shifting in this too, this from Medical Express. As Delta variant infections surge, more Americans favor vaccine mandates. As infections from the Delta variant surge, the percentage of Americans who support vaccine mandates has risen to 64% from 58% in April. According to the latest poll by the COVID States Project, majorities of respondents from nearly all states approve an overall vaccine mandate as well as specific mandates for plane travel and in-person schooling. Major differences were seen in terms of party affiliation and where respondents lived. Democrats were twice as likely as Republicans to approve such mandates, 84% to 45%, and rural residents were 20 percentage points less supportive of mandates than urban dwellers, 73% to 53%. And in case you need any reminding, this is a global pandemic. So let's look at this from the Center for Global Development. The U.S. is losing the global war against COVID-19. And that is a national security issue. Imagine if 600,000 Americans and 4 million worldwide had been killed in a terrorist attack, and 50,000 were still being killed every week. Would our response look like what we are doing to fight COVID-19 across the world? The fight against COVID-19 is a global war, but policymakers are not behaving accordingly. As a result, we are losing more battles than we are winning, and the scars will haunt our international relations for years to come. Produce a credible, time-bound, and costed global battle plan and assign clear accountability for its implementation. A sad reality of global health is that no one is in charge. The alphabet soup of WHO, World Bank, UNICEF, CEPI, Gavi, COVAX, IMF, and WTO are all play important roles in fighting the pandemic, but none of them has been charged with producing a credible and costed operational battle plan to get the world vaccinated. A year into the pandemic, four of the leading international agencies have set up a joint task force. I'd prefer that they think of it as a war room to try and produce a coordinated global response. As their largest and most important shareholder, the U.S. should ask for a global battle plan by September 1st and to nominate a single official who has the authority and accountability to deliver. That plan needs to have an authoritative monthly delivery plan for vaccines, logistics for getting these vaccines to each country in need, support for to ensure these countries will have the capacity in place to deploy the vaccines when they arrive, and a war footing effort to scale short and long-term vaccine production in every available factory worldwide. Financing is not an acceptable constraint. Money shortfalls are a sorry excuse for explaining where we are today. There is no excuse for the time and attention that senior policymakers are having to devote to filling a gap in the low tens of billions of dollars to get the world vaccinated. The administration has just proposed a $3.5 trillion budget, and the G7 countries spent $12 trillion last year responding to the crisis. Yet the ACT Accelerator has a funding gap of $16.7 billion to deliver tests, vaccines, and treatments around the world. For perspective, that's a third of what the world spent on cosmetic surgery in 2018. It's time to stop, quote, passing the parcel at every international meeting and take a decision at the upcoming G20 summit to do what it takes to combat the worst health and human security risk in almost a century. No one is safe until everyone is safe has become an overused platitude, but in this case, it's gravely true. For our own safety, and because it is the right thing to do, a war footing is necessary to end this global pandemic. This will only happen if the U.S. makes it its number one international priority and then builds a multilateral coalition of allies and institutions to do the same. Together, we can deliver a world where we live free from fear and uncertainty about the resurgence of this deadly enemy. That should be our goal and mission for the months ahead. Okay, well, let's bring it back a little closer to home and talk about what's happening in Ohio, and then we'll do the local update. This from MSN. Delta variant is everywhere in Ohio. Governor Mike DeWine urges more vaccinations as COVID cases rise. Delta spreads like wildfire, and it seeks out anyone who is not vaccinated. This is the warning from Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, the chief medical officer for the Ohio Department of Health, as he joined Governor Mike DeWine last Friday at a COVID-19 press conference. That briefing marked the first time Governor DeWine has hosted a COVID-focused media event in several weeks, which comes as the state experiences a growing number of new infections. We now have this Delta variant that is everywhere in Ohio, said Dr. Vanderhoff, as Dr. Vanderhoff a month ago predicted, Governor DeWine said during the question and answer portion of his press conference. In an effort to counter the ongoing spread, Governor DeWine repeatedly urged more Ohioans to get vaccinated. The essential fact is that we have three vaccines that are highly, highly effective, Governor DeWine said. They're so powerful that we live in a state with two groups of people, those who are vaccinated and those who are not vaccinated. The name of the game today is vaccines, Governor DeWine said. This is where we win. This is where we don't win. Delta is dominant, and it is the culprit, Vanderhoff said. He then highlighted these three key things about the Delta variant. One, it is absolutely more contagious. This simply means that it takes less of the virus to go from an infected person's nose and mouth to go to another person's nose and mouth. Two, more contagious than the common cold or the flu. Delta is now more dangerous than prior versions of the virus. We now have data from Canada and from Scotland that show people infected with the Delta variant have a much higher likelihood of needing to be hospitalized. There is mounting evidence that the viral loads associated with the Delta variant are higher than we saw with previous strains of the virus. What that means is that Delta is reproducing itself, creating more copies of itself much more quickly once it gets inside our bodies. Okay, well, let's do the local Lucas County COVID-19 update. Well, cases and hospitalizations are accelerating in Lucas County. Our 7-day daily average for cases went from 29 to 43 over the last week, which puts us at a rate of 117, which is still lower than the state rate of 173. But the important metric to remember is that Governor DeWine was talking about lifting restrictions when we got down to 50. Now the state is over triple that level. And you can hear a pin drop when you're talking about reinstating mitigation efforts. Bum, 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 bum. It's hard to go in reverse for so many reasons. But the Delta variant seems to be going forward with very little difficulty. So the testing positivity rate, the percent of people who seek testing, get testing, then actually test positive, jumped up from 3.1% to 5.7% in Lucas County over the last week. And we passed up that metric of trying to keep that under 5%, which is an indication that we're doing enough testing. So even 15 plus months into this pandemic, we are still having problems with getting adequate testing. We are actually both nationally, statewide, and locally doing less testing than we were last year at the same time. So unfortunately, the testing positivity rate is even worse than the state. It went up from 5.3% to 6.5% over the last week. But even that is much better than what it is nationally, where it's about 10%. And nationally, the number of cases have only been this high since last January. Yikes. When we were really in the thick of it. And it is the rates are going up. Okay, well, back in Lucas County in the long-term care centers or nursing homes, we still maintain zero residents with active cases, but we bumped up some more cases in the staff of long-term care facilities where six staff are now infected where it was two last week. And the hospitalizations are rising steadily in both Lucas County and Ohio, and they have about doubled in the last 2 weeks. Deaths nationally are rising steadily. We've cracked an average over the last week of more than 500 deaths per day, and that seems to be no end. Of course, there's a lag between a rise in cases and hospitalizations and deaths. Okay, well, this week, we're going to switch over officially from reporting on those who have been at least partially vaccinated or at least started their vaccination to those that are fully vaccinated. The good news, I guess, is that the U.S. actually passed the halfway mark at 50.1% of the U.S. population being fully vaccinated. We'll give a little shout out for that. Woo-hoo. Of course, Ohio and Lucas County are dragging behind that. Ohio is only 46.5% of its population fully vaccinated, and Lucas County only has 45.7% fully vaccinated. And as has been in recent weeks, while vaccinations are ticking up slightly, the tick up is slower in Ohio and Lucas County than the U.S. as a whole, and it looks like it's going to be well into the fall before we get to much higher levels. It's slow, but we are making some progress. Hopefully, we can keep the rates that we have now continuing for the next several months before flu season hits. Okay, well, and looking at the racial ethnic disparity, converting it over from those that are partially vaccinated at least to those that are fully vaccinated, Lucas County blacks in blacks in Lucas County are only 58% as likely to be fully vaccinated as whites in Lucas County. And actually, the gap between Lucas County and Ohio is even wider when you're looking at full vaccination, basically meaning that blacks in Lucas County are a little less likely to actually complete the full vaccination and remain partially vaccinated. In Ohio, 73% blacks are 73% as likely as whites to have been fully vaccinated. Well, folks, you're listening to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. This is Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM. Okay, well, let's move on to some non-COVID public health news for a change. This from the Public Health Newswire. U.S. healthcare ranks last among wealthy countries. The U.S. healthcare system ranks last when compared to other wealthy countries, according to a new analysis from the Commonwealth Fund. A new report released finds that when compared to 10 other high-income countries, people in the U.S. are more likely to be unable to afford health insurance, suffer early death from a lack of timely health care, and have their treatment slowed by administrative red tape. The U.S. also has the widest health disparity between high and low-income people. In similar news from Public Health Newswire, U.S. health disparities persist, worsen in some areas, report finds. Health disparities in the U.S. are both persistent and oftentimes getting worse, according to a recent report from America's Health Rankings. Released by the United Health Foundation, the disparities report and accompanying interactive website are based on decades of data on dozens of health-related measures, including social determinants. At the national level, for example, the new report found deep and persistent disparities in mental and behavioral health by gender, educational attainment, and race and ethnicity. Other key findings include ongoing and growing disparities in maternal death rates and widening gaps in food security. Overall, the report, which is based on data collected before the COVID-19 pandemic, found a strong link between education and health. Americans without a high school education face the greatest health, economic, and social challenges, as well as the biggest health disparities. While the U.S. has made progress on a number of health measures, the report found that not all communities have benefited equally. For example, the nation's overall uninsured rate dropped significantly within the past decade. However, the uninsured rate was still 3.5 times higher among people with only a high school degree compared to college graduates, and 3 times higher among Hispanics and American Indian and Alaskan Native people than among whites. Racial gaps were especially wide across states. For instance, between 2015 and 2019, American Indian and Alaskan Native populations in Wyoming had an uninsured rate 24 times higher than white populations in Washington, D.C. The nation also made progress on addressing deaths from black infants, with rates declining in 22 states since the early 2000s. But the rankings report found that black babies face the highest infant mortality rate in the nation, with a rate nearly 3 times higher than Asian and Pacific Islander babies. On maternal death, rates and disparities worsened. Okay, well, I'm pointing to a solution to some of this. This from Medical Express. Expanding Medicare would reduce racial and ethnic health disparities. When Americans become eligible for Medicare coverage at age 65, research has shown there's substantial reductions in racial and ethnic disparities in health insurance, access to care, and self-reported health. Lowering the eligibility age to age 60 would further reduce disparities, new research led by the Yale School of Public Health finds. The findings were published in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine. For example, the study found that racial and ethnic disparities in insurance coverage fell by more than 50% at age 65. Narrowing the coverage gap translated into meaningful reductions in both access and health disparities. For example, entry to Medicare reduced disparities that exist between white and Hispanic people under 65 by 29% among people who have practitioners they consider their regular healthcare providers, 39% for the share of people unable to see a physician because of cost, and 59% for flu vaccinations. Finally, disparities between white respondents and racial and ethnic minorities among respondents in poor self-reported health narrowed by more than 40% with Medicare coverage. This is an important finding as self-reported health has been found to be a strong predictor of mortality, researchers say. For the study, the researchers also investigated whether Medicare's impact on racial and ethnic disparities persisted after passage of the Affordable Care Act, a national insurance expansion introduced in 2010. While it is well documented that the Affordable Care Act reduced racial and ethnic disparities in health coverage, the research team found that the post-Affordable Care Act period eligibility for Medicare once recipients turn 65 further reduce these disparities substantially. Looks like it's time for health for all, Medicare for all.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, some more coverage on health disparities. This from Medical Express. Headaches are vastly undertreated among racial and socioeconomic groups. Significant disparities exist in diagnosing and treating headaches by race, socioeconomic level, and insurance status, despite the fact that headaches afflict nearly all racial and ethnic groups at the same rate, according to research led by University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center faculty. Latinos are 50% less likely to receive a migraine diagnosis than whites, and African American men receive the least care for headache diseases nationwide, according to a review article published in the journal Neurology. The undertreatment of headaches in black patients is consistent with the available data on undertreatment of pain in these individuals and is believed to be partially influenced by the false view that African Americans are more biologically tolerant to pain. This erroneous belief has historically led to healthcare disparities, the study says. Other findings included non-white children were less likely to receive medication for headaches, and they were three times less likely to receive imaging than white children. Black children are less likely to have emergency room visits for pediatric sports-related head injuries. Lower-income groups have a 60% higher rate of migraines. Uninsured adults with migraines are twice as likely, and public-insured adults 1.5 times as likely to receive to not receive evidence-based treatment compared with commercially insured adults with migraines. Okay, well, next up, I want to do a couple stories on a highly prevalent but not so much talked about health problem that includes vision and hearing. First up, this from Medical Express. The United Nations adopts first resolution on vision, aims to help 1 billion worldwide. The UN General Assembly approved its first ever resolution on vision, calling on its 193 member nations to ensure access to eye care for everyone in their countries, which would contribute to a global effort to help at least 1.1 billion people with vision impairment who currently lack eye services by 2030. the Vision for Everyone resolution, sponsored by Bangladesh, Antigua, and Ireland, and co-sponsored by over 100 countries, was adopted by consensus by the world body. It encourages countries to institute a whole-of-government approach to eye care, and it calls on international financial institutions and donors to provide targeted financing, especially for developing countries, to address the increasing impact of vision loss on economic and social development. According to the resolution, at least 2 billion people are living with vision impairment or blindness, and 1.1 billion people have vision impairment that could have been prevented or is yet to be addressed. Global eye care needs are projected to increase substantially, with half the global population expected to be living with a vision impairment by 2050. Bangladesh's UN Ambassador Rabab Fatima introduced the resolution, stressing its first ever focus on vision and calling it a long overdue recognition of the central role that healthy vision plays in human life and for sustainable development. She said over 90% of the 1.1 billion people worldwide with vision loss live in low and middle income countries, adding that 55% of blind people are women and girls. The resolution stresses that access to eye care is essential to achieve the United Nations goals for 2030 to end poverty and hunger, ensure healthy lives and quality education, and reduce inequality. And next up, hearing difficulties in the U.S., this from Medical Express. 13% experience difficulty hearing, even with hearing aid. In 2019, 13% of adults had some difficulty hearing, even when using a hearing aid, according to a July data brief published by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention National Center for Health Statistics. The researchers found that 13% of adults had some difficulty hearing, and 1.6% had a lot of difficulty hearing or could not hear at all, even when using a hearing aid in 2019. There was an increase in hearing difficulties with age, with 27% and 4% of those aged 65 years and older having some difficulty and having a lot of difficulty or not hearing at all, respectively. Men were more likely than women to have had some or a lot of difficulty hearing or could not hear at all among adults aged 45 years and older. The rates of having some difficulty, a lot of difficulty, or being unable to hear at all were increased for non-Hispanic whites aged 45 to 64 compared with other race and Hispanic origin groups. Advancements in hearing aid technology have resulted in improvements in hearing ability with the use of these aids, but, as shown in this report, hearing difficulties remain even when these hearing aids are used, the authors write. And I would note on the whole vision and hearing loss thing, and I'll add to that dental, are things that are being considered to be strengthened and added to Medicare, which would be a big boost in overall total body health. Okay, well, in recent weeks, I've reported on that kind of crazy approval of a basically unproven Alzheimer's drug. But going a little bit broader of a perspective, we want to look at the accelerated pathway for drug approval that's been used for this Aduhelm. This Alzheimer's drug has been used many times before, and it isn't really a good idea. So this from Medical Express. FDA allows drugs without proven clinical benefit to languish for years on accelerated pathway. Since the U.S. Food and Drug Administration established its accelerated approval pathway for drugs in 1992, nearly half of the 253 drugs, 112 drugs, authorized have not been confirmed as clinically effective, an investigation by the British Medical Journal has found. Elizabeth Mahas, clinical director at the British Medical Journal, carried out an in-depth analysis of FDA data up to December 31st, 2020, and found that of these 112 drugs approved in the last 28 years, a fifth, or 24 of them, have been on the market for more than 5 years, and some have been on the market for more than two decades, often with a hefty price tag. The accelerated pathway allows drugs on the market before efficacy has been proven, she explains. But as part of the approval, the manufacturer must conduct post-approval studies known as Phase 4 confirmatory trials to, quote, verify the anticipated clinical benefit. If these trials show no benefit, the drug's approval can be canceled. But further analysis of FDA data revealed that only 16 drugs approved through the pathway have ever been withdrawn. Most of these were shown to lack efficacy, but in some cases the confirmatory trials were never done. Despite the pathway's good intentions to accelerate the availability of drugs that treat serious diseases, experts are concerned that it is now being exploited to the detriment of patients who may be prescribed a drug that offers little benefit and possible harm, and to taxpayers. Hussein Nasi, associate professor of health policy at the London School of Economics, expressed concern, saying, We may have drugs on the market that don't have any benefits, but certainly predictably have PARMs associated with them. In April 2021, the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review reported that a lack of credible threats to withdraw approval if companies didn't carry out confirmatory trials meant that study sponsors had little incentive to even do them. One effective reform could be that confirmatory trials are designed, agreed, and even started as part of the approval. Other suggestions include strengthening the selection of surrogate endpoints, regulating the price of accelerated drugs, and regularly re-reviewing and renewing the approval to ensure that it continues to justify the risk-benefit trade-off.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, let's now do a couple stories on dementia, a tricky and stubborn health problem. This from Medical Express. Blood cholesterol in middle age linked to dementia and Alzheimer's disease more than 10 years later. High levels of low-density lipoprotein cholesterol in midlife are associated with increased risk of developing dementia and Alzheimer's over a decade later, according to a study published in the Lancet Healthy Longevity. The largest study to date provides the strongest evidence so far on the relationship between blood cholesterol and dementia and Alzheimer's disease. These results were not attributed to body mass index, the use of statins, or the ApoE gamma 4 allele, a gene variant associated with both increased LDL cholesterol and increased risk of dementia. The researchers therefore call for LDL cholesterol to be added to the few potentially modifiable risk factors for dementia and Alzheimer's disease. The strength of this association is comparable with other modifiable risk factors such as alcohol consumption and greater than for blood pressure. So, you know, Alzheimer's is one of those scary things that we think there's no way to prevent it, but it looks like there are a number of things, and we really need to add kind of heart health, since that the vasculature in your brain is not entirely different than the vasculature in the rest of your body. And you can add this to such things as blood pressure and alcohol consumption as risk for dementia. And looking at dementia worldwide, this from Science Daily. New analysis shows a decrease in prevalence due to education, countered by an increase due to heart health risk factors. Positive trends in global education access are expected to decrease dementia prevalence worldwide by 6.2 million cases by the year 2050. Meanwhile, anticipated trends in smoking, high body mass index, and high blood sugar are predicted to increase prevalence by nearly the same number, 6.8 million cases. Both according to a new global prevalence data report at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference. The number of people with dementia will nearly triple to more than 152 million by 2050. The U.S. National Institute on Aging estimates people over the age of 65 will make up 16% of the world's population by 2050, up from 8% in 2010. Okay, next up from Medical Express, a story on cancer. Healthy lifestyle may help mitigate high genetic risk of cancer. Healthy lifestyle factors such as absence from smoking and drinking, low body mass index, and exercise correlated with decreased cancer incidence, even in individuals with high genetic risk, according to result of a study published in Cancer Research, a journal of the American Association for Cancer Research. Our findings indicate that everyone should have a healthy lifestyle to decrease overall cancer risk. This is particularly important for individuals with a high genetic risk of cancer. So I've talked about this before, and this is true for risk factors even more than just cancer, like even heart disease risk factors, is if you're at particularly high risk, You can actually lower your risk proportionally, but if you have a higher absolute risk, that means you get a higher absolute benefit from doing preventive measures. So the thing is, we should not get discouraged by the fact that we have a high absolute risk from doing preventive things, because we get a proportionally greater gain by doing these very same things. So don't give up on preventive measures, even if you find out that you have a high genetic risk for cancer or even heart disease. Both of those respond to preventive measures proportionally to the amount that you can achieve those measures. Okay, well, I want to close the show with a couple stories about firearm injuries. This from Medical Express. New guidelines intended to help health providers prevent gun injuries and deaths. Each year, approximately 40,000 people in the United States die because of guns, making firearm-related injuries a leading cause of death for adults and children. According to a recent report, gun violence surged during the COVID-19 pandemic, making 2020 one of the nation's deadliest year for firearm-related casualties on record. Healthcare professionals can help reduce the toll, but only about 20% receive any education on their role in firearm injury prevention. With the goal of changing that, a consortium of scientists, physicians, and educators from across the country, a significant number of whom are firearm owners, established new guidelines on educational priorities regarding firearm injury prevention training for healthcare professionals. The guidelines were published this month in the journal Academic Medicine. Our job as clinicians is to help patients stay healthy, said Dr. Megan Rainey, a Brown University professor of emergency medicine who is a senior author of the study and served as a mentor and advisor on the project. We ask and counsel about a lot of things, ranging from diet to smoking to seatbelts to pool safety. Yet study after study has shown that we do not do that for firearm injury. When providers have thoughtful, culturally competent conversations with patients and families about firearms, Rainey said, they can change behavior to increase safety. Research shows that after a conversation with a pediatrician about firearm injury prevention, parents are more likely to store guns safely, for example. Another study showed that violence intervention programs can help reduce injuries among young trauma patients admitted to a hospital after shootings or stabbings. The problem is that these conversations aren't happening, the researchers say. In many cases, physicians haven't felt comfortable talking about firearms with patients because it's viewed as a divisive subject, said Catherine Hoops, a study author and assistant professor of anesthesiology and critical care medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. We set out to change that by being the first to create standards for undergraduate, graduate, and continuing medical education, so clinicians and educators have a foundation from which they can develop educational programming for their learners. As examples, according to the researchers, clinicians should know the frequency, patterns, and risk factors for fatal and non-fatal firearm injury, including suicide and suicide attempts, understand firearm access, possession, ownership, transfer, and use, and be familiar with basic types of firearms and ammunition. They should also be able to provide counseling about firearm injury prevention, such as safe gun storage, to their patients and understand how to escalate concerns for patients who may be at risk. This isn't an anti-firearm set of objectives, Rainey said, but a harm reduction set of objectives. While the vast majority of firearm ownership is tied to beliefs and practices around gun safety, she added, there are certain situations, practices, and societal factors that elevate risk. These guidelines are about teaching medical professionals how to identify those gradations of risk and how to act appropriately to lower them. The conversation around gun safety is similar to how I talk to patients about car seats. I counsel them on how to safely put their child in the seat, but I don't tell them how to drive. Fahimi said the authors hope that the educational framework will fundamentally change how physicians talk about violence in their practices. It's engaging with patients, talking about their experiences, helping them understand the risk of injury, and ultimately preventing injuries and saving lives. Okay, we're going to close on one more article about firearm injuries. This is from Medical Express and the Medical University of South Carolina. Non-fatal firearm injuries lead to increased chance of mental health disorder in youth. For every youth who dies from injury from a firearm, at least four survive. These survivors led researchers at the Medical University of South Carolina Health to look at new mental health diagnoses that may stem from non-fatal gunshot wounds in adolescents. This research team found that children with an underlying mental illness already have a higher baseline risk for injury from a firearm, and once injured, the same children have a greater risk of developing additional mental disorders. Any physical disability they may experience from the injury adds to any mental stress they may also be feeling. The level of risk depends on the type of mental health disorder prior to injury. Children diagnosed with depression are at higher risk for suicide. Conduct disorder is another risk factor, as children with conduct disorders or substance-related disorders are more likely to be involved in community violence. While more common in boys than girls, the lifetime prevalence of conduct disorder is 12% for boys and 7% for girls, according to American Family Medicine. This paper just goes to show that the mental health epidemic in this country and the firearm violence epidemic in this country are intertwined. It is important for us to address mental health needs in the population of children who have suffered a firearm injury. Okay, well, if you haven't got enough public health news, there's a few bonus articles, actually only two this week, that are available online for additional reading, and you can also get the articles that I've covered it on this episode. The first bonus article is "The Anti-Vaccine Con Job is Becoming Untenable: Why Targets of Deliberate Deception Often Hesitate to Admit They've Been Deceived." And second, "Climate Change Will Bring Heavier Storms and Our Sewers Aren't Ready." A good story about the basic infectious disease infrastructure that we often take for granted, which is good sewers and sanitation. You can read these and other articles on toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-